And he mentioned he wanted to be here to do this. He knows Bryson really well, as I do, and but couldn't make it for work reasons. And so he reached out to me and says, "Oh, you know, can you introduce Bryson as our speaker tonight?" And I was like, "Yes, I'll do that." Bryson's somebody that I've rubbed shoulders with and just, you know, participated in the recovery of Al-Anon now for over 10 years, and I've seen him do a lot of different things with his life in that time. And he's one of those guys in Al-Anon that, well, let's see, what's the best way to put it? Very unique and but truly in Al-Anon. And his story was one, as soon as I heard it, I never forgot it. It's just like one of those kind of things. And so I can say for sure tonight you guys are in for a major treat. And you know, that being said, I'll turn the time over now to Bryce and he can tell you his story.
How y'all doing? How y'all doing? I'm Bryson. Though I always start the same way, though I look like it and sometimes I act like it, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I'm glad to see everybody on Zoom. Willie, I wore my ID, so there you go. Willie and I have an ongoing joke about my redneck ID being from down south from many years ago. Y'all who've been around here for a while. I saw a couple of them out here too. So, yeah, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about, you know, what this room and the men in this room mean to me, but I have to address it. It means so much to me. This meeting's known around the country. I get to speak sometimes and travel, and people talk about it and ask me about it. It's known around Los Angeles. You guys are a beacon. My home group is Saturday morning, New Hampshire meeting. It's a hybrid meeting too. It's in Hollywood, and we send all the new guys up here when they ask. We always talk to people about there's a, you know, Hollywood. We talk about Valley Al-Anon. If you want to get real, get out and get that Valley Al-Anon, and but yeah, man, just the cats are here. I mean, I live in a house, Ron R. I rent from Ron R's family. We found our house, and my wife, I told the story on here last time, but we went to find a house, and I was out of town. My wife went to look, and she was like, "Well, I'll look at these two houses and I'll make the decision." She went to one, she prayed, she meditated. She went down to meet the other one. The guy that came out of the house with the keys was wearing a 70LR hat. And she said, "Do you know Bryson?" He said, "Well, yeah, I know Bryson." And you know, so I'm connected, you know, daily to this place. And I nearly got Brian killed about 20 years ago at a Johnny Cash show. No, it was a Dwight Yoakam show. And nearly got him in a fight when he was, I love that, pre-recovery. We're talking about that, pre-Al-Anon. He was like, "Yeah, I love that you came to Al-Anon. I guess you didn't know I was an Al-Anon at that point. I was probably a year in and I was still in that fighting mood," but just hilarious. But the main thing I want to say is that I was never friends with men when I was growing up. I was scared to death of men. And when I look back on it, when I did some inventory and I got a little clear-headed and looked at it, it's like a lot of those men had a beer in their hand. I'll just tell you that. That's all I know. It's a lot of those men that I was scared of and intimidated by. And I never developed intimate friendships and relationships and open honesty with men. And as a result, I never developed that with women either. So the men in this program have healed me. In a way that I also didn't expect. You know, Brian, that was a beautiful thing you said. I it's very funny because, you know, I love in the Just for Today, you know, it's like, you know, dress becomingly, criticize not one bit. And when I came in almost about 24 years ago, I came in, you know, they would be like, "Dress up for the podium," you know, and you go to a meeting and, you know, and I believe in respecting the podium, but there's part of my story that I it happened to me a few years ago. I got invited to speak. Now think of this setting. I got to, invited to speak as the out-on speaker at the San Fernando Valley AA convention at like 9 o'clock on a Friday night. So y'all can imagine what that was like. And all my friends, I have a bunch of double winner friends, and obviously I'm in this program, so I have a lot of friends who are alcoholics. And they were all there down front winding me up. And I was wound up. I was like, oh, it's gonna be late. I better drink some coffee. And I was fired up. And man, I told every crazy story and I just cussed my way through this pitch. And after it was done, it was great. And this is such a great Al-Anon moment for you. I hope y'all relate. I'm sitting there and everybody comes through the receiving line and I'm like, thank you. And everybody's like, oh, so nice. And I'm receiving the hugs. And that's the hardest thing, by the way. My wife, one of the most profound things I've ever heard, my wife, who's a sober alcoholic and a member of Al-Anon, says that she believes that alcoholism blocks our ability to give and receive love. That has been my experience as well, that this disease robs us of the ability to give and receive love. And receiving love is even harder. My first sponsor, you know, people would come up and say, hey, that was great, man. I'd do something. They go, that was great. And I go, no, no, man, no. And I look down, no, look to the ground. And, you know, he taught me that was arrogance, that I was telling somebody that what I knew better than they did, that I need to listen to them and just listen to them. And I got to the point where I could go and shake their hand. Then I got to the point where I could look them in the eye and grit my teeth and receive that. And then I got to the point where I could smile, say, thank you. And that was a process. That was a few years to get there. But so this receiving line's going on and all these people are coming through and all my rowdy AA buddies and everybody, and then some nice little ladies from the valley come through and this one woman comes up to me and she goes, I loved your story. And she leaned in and hugged me and she said, but I just so worried that someone might come into this room and you know, hear you cussing and telling these stories and just think that that's what Al-Anon's all about all the time. And I was like, oh man. And then she went on and like another 100 people came by and said, hey, that was great. And I was like, oh, so anyway, I'm walking out with a sober buddy of mine and I'm just feeling like, man, because I'm not remembering the 200 people that were like, thank you for being of service. I remember the one lady who was like, hey, I hope you didn't ruin someone's life. And I tell this story all the time that I said, I think one of the heaviest like punk rock band names you could have would be Al-Anon Business Meeting. And I told that story. And in the story, I said, yeah. I said, man, oh, you're an agnostic front? Oh, that's adorable. I'm an Al-Anon Business Meeting, dude. I'm hard. And everybody laughed and stuff. And so anyway, so I'm walking out of the hotel and we're in the lobby, man. I'm talking to my friend. And, you know, it's like me. I'm, you know, my friend's a sober alcoholic, by the way. So I need to tell that part. So I'm walking by and I'm like, man, I feel bad. Man, I did. And he's just like, man, F that lady. You know, he's just, you know, totally giving the alcoholic view of like, what? And this girl runs up to me and she's all dressed in black. She got black hair. She got, you know, white, like kind of makeup on. She runs up and she goes, I can't believe you mentioned Agnostic Front. And she said, I just thank you so much. She said, I always feel left out. I always feel like I don't fit in these rooms. And she said, I just want to thank you. Like, I feel like I heard my story. And gave me a hug. And, you know, my buddy looked at me. He's like, there you go. And so I have decided that, like, yeah, I don't know. My story is my story. I am who I am. I, you know, I love this program. I love all of y'all. I'm sorry if y'all, you know, if I cuss, I'm sorry. But fuck it, you know. Because I, you know, when I came in, everybody was like, it was a bunch of old white ladies. I just got to say it. It was a bunch of old white ladies. And now I have to admit that they were all probably younger than me. It's just so we all know here. And that's how I felt. And I felt really weird and out of place. And I kept my head down. I had a black leather jacket and had my hair down on my face. And I just sat there and they talked and they told stories. And as I listened, I realized that they were saying the same things I was feeling. that no matter what the outside looked like, the inside was the same. They talk about that common language of the heart that we all speak. And so for me, that was a healing part of this thing for me. And that's kind of part of my story, man. Timing myself up here. So I don't like to talk too much about the mess and my story, but I'll kind of run it down for y'all in terms of it. And then I want to get to kind of today, because at this point, over 20 years in, things change. You know, Eric and I were talking about, I've had a bottom recently. I've had some rough times. And so we'll talk about that. But the basic stories of it is that this is not a completely an act. I grew up down south. Actually in Brian, when Brian, when that guy was mouthing out, a big dude, I'll just give you a quick thing. He said, I'm from Newport, Arkansas, is what I said. And this guy, wasn't impressed, but anyway, yeah, man, I was raised by, my dad was a farmer and a pro rodeo cowboy. And my family was hard, man. We're hard, hard, hard. This year, my family's, there was a tornado in Arkansas and it wiped out what's called Jones Hill. Four of my family's houses, all the farm equipment, the granaries, everything wiped out in about just 5 minutes, gone. And that was Friday night at 11. And they dug my aunt and uncle out of the houses that they were buried in the rubble, and they sent them to the hospital. And at 6 a.m., the neighbors showed up and they cleared everything off that plot. And by Monday, they were back at work. And I said, I said, my grandfather's name was Abraham Lincoln, my last name. And I said, we call him Paul Abe. And he said, man, Paul Abe didn't tell us how to feel our feelings, but he sure as hell told us how to get the hell on and get on with it. And today, after years of hanging around with y'all, I can check in with my cousins who are there. And I can check in with my family and make sure they're all right and make sure that they got somebody to talk to and they know that I love them and I care about them. And that was not my experience. So I grew up down south. I think last time I was here, I said, an old line of mine, I said, I was raised with all the care and gentleness you'd expect of a bull rider. But that's not necessarily even my story, I lost my mom this last year, and I'll be damned if so many of my character defects didn't come from her. My parents divorced when I was 7, and if you had asked me, my dad was the villain and my mom was the hero, but my mom was an admitted Al-Anon. She was a member of Al-Anon for a little while. And man, my character defects so much came from her. And so many of my assets came from my dad. And I didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to see that. But if you do these steps and you do the inventory and you can get honest and you can talk to people, over time, you start to realize things like that and you can see them. And I can still love my mom for all the flaws and what went on, So my parents divorced when I was 7. Neither of my parents are alcoholics. I don't know if my grandfathers were alcoholics, but I do know that like some of their behaviors I've heard described probably would have bothered me. And I know there was a lot of alcohol involved. I had a great aunt. My grandmother's sister was an alcoholic, and we would go drive around and go find my aunt in the beer joints. My grandma was a church lady driving around looking for her sister, go into a beer joint and pull her out of there. And I think about it now and I'm like, I remember the feeling. I remember feeling that fear. I feel like I caught that fear. It's a family disease. I feel like I know that fear came into me. The first time I remember feeling that fear was riding around in the back seat with my grandma going to these rough ass beer joints looking for my aunt. And so alcohol was around. Saddest thing about where I'm from is that there is not a lot of recovery. I want to thank everybody who puts this Zoom meeting on. As much as people sometimes hate hybrid meetings or hate Zoom meetings, it is life-saving when you live in a town of 7,000 people and there is no way to get recovery other than that. So just want to say, like, for me, it's my personal opinion and my experience that Zoom has been life-saving for us. I didn't have that. Had a lot of alcoholism, not a lot of recovery. And I like to tell people that so I was raised in a church. My religion taught me that God loved me and wanted to kill me. And I had a Sunday morning God and a Saturday night life. And I could not bring God into that Saturday night life. Like that God I had, that higher power, didn't work for me. And so I had to hide a good chunk of my life from my higher power. As silly as that sounds, for those of us who've experienced a higher power. And so when I was in my mid-teens, I just sort of was like, yeah, I don't think I'm gonna do this anymore. And I left myself, kind of running things. And my take on a higher power and my take on, like, I had crushing, crippling anxiety when I was a teenager and when I was in my early 20s. And I think back on it now and I tell people, I'm like, okay, well, I did inventory and I looked at how I treated myself and I looked at how I thought about myself. And I was like, well, you clearly don't like this guy. All that stuff you did, you clearly hate this guy. So to hate myself so much, to think that I was the worst person in the world, and then to have the bad feeling in the back of my head that I was running my life. It's terrifying. Unbelievable. The worst person I knew was in charge of my life, me. Horrible. How do you live like that? And I can tell you, not well, not well for anyone around me. And so for me, that was the deal. And I had that feeling that a lot of people have. I didn't fit in. I didn't want to fit in. I have to take ownership of that. I didn't want to fit in. I grew my hair out. I was a complete freak. I dressed crazy in a little tiny town. And I just didn't, whatever was going on, I didn't want any of it. Man, I liked chaotic people a lot. If you're looking for chaotic people, you figure out that alcoholics and drug addicts they know how to do chaos. And if you don't want anybody to look at you and kind of take your inventory, well, you need somebody who's a little worse off than you around you. Makes you look a lot better. Just a little pro life tip for y'all. And I just found a series of people. I didn't think I deserved anything. I didn't think I deserved anything. I talk about being a kid, and we were all well off, and we were divorced. My mom divorced my dad, but like I had everything I needed. But in school, I had all these memories when I was trying to do my inventory, stuff would come up, and I remember being like, "Oh, I didn't have like pencils and paper and stuff." I was talking to my mom, she was like, "What are you talking about?" And I was like, "Yeah," and I was always borrowing lunch money and pencils and papers and stuff and all, and I realized that like, my mom would take me to get school supplies when school started, and then I couldn't ask her when they ran out. So I just begged, borrowing, from people, and rather than ask for anything, for a pencil. And that's, needless, wantless. They talk about this, unwanted, unloved, alone. I took that to an extreme because then I made it like, well, and I won't ask for anything. And that's how this disease affected me in that way. I got went to college. I now think I was probably clinically depressed, but the symptoms that I had when I came into Al-Anon had really started to present really bad, and I had a bunch of anxiety, and I was restless and terrified, and it was heavy, and so that didn't work. So naturally, I needed some safety, so I moved to Los Angeles, and specifically to Hollywood and Highland in 1987. So that was cool. I never said it like that. And it's so crazy when I think about it now. Like, hey man, you're anxious. You should go to Hollywood. That'll chill you out. I was like, hey, y'all, what's a gang? Anyway, man, I tell people all the time, like I said, I travel, I talk to people. I'm like, yeah, man, like LA can make alcoholics and addicts. And that's why we're good at putting them back together. The recovery in Los Angeles, man, y'all, Southern California recovery is crazy good. There's a million meetings, a million amazing people, a lot of them right here sitting in this room. And but that's the truth, man. You can mess up bad and you can also put it together here. I really focused on the mess it up bad for the first probably 15 years I was here. And really what happened is just lower and lower companions, you know, just more and more chaos. I felt worse. I felt like I deserved less and less. And so I went and found less and less and I sought it out. And a lot of those people that I was friends with, a lot of those women I were in relationships with, a lot of them were sober now. And I love that, you know. It also doing inventory, I realized that it was, you know, it takes two to tango. And I was cutting a rug. And so that I was, you know, a lot of people when I came in, I was like, oh, they were so crazy. And it's like, man, nobody was as crazy as me. And that's really what got me in here is I hit it hit the pinnacle of unavailability and this like sober alcoholic addict cokehead girl broke 8 years of sobriety with me out in the desert. I bought her a shot of tequila. She said, you're sober. I bought her a shot of tequila. So when it says find out more about alcoholism in the reading, you should do that. You should know not to do that. And so and she went, like they say, man, she went right back to where she was 8 years ago, and she just hit the bottom fast. And I was crazier than her. And she said to me, you're scaring me, and you have a hole inside you. Have a, you know, the classic cliche, you have a God-sized hole inside you and you're trying to fill it with all this stuff. And I had been to Al-Anon before, about a year before that, a little more. And I had bottomed out before and I got about 6 months of recovery. And then I left and there's nothing more dangerous than an Al-Anon on the streets with like 6 months of the book and no sponsor, no meetings. It's just a bunch of crazy ideas. Self-righteousness, Jesus. And so, but I went back to Little White Chapel in Burbank and went to that meeting, and those people didn't seem so alien. And there's a guy named John, big tall dude. He had white hair, and I was there, you know, come back, been gone for about a year, all shameful and shit. And men were very shaming to me in my past, in my childhood. Shame is a big part of my story. And so he came up after the meeting and saw me and walked over there to me. And I was almost flinching. I just was like, and he goes, hey, how you doing? How you been? I said, good, but not good enough. And I was ready for the smart ass comment. You know, why haven't you been here? Whatever shit he was going to say to me. And he just said, it's good to see you. I'm glad you're back. And he walked away. And I credit that moment with me understanding this program was real. That I understood that dude who was a big, tall, old dude, that's my, my Godzilla terrified. And he's just like, yeah, man, good to see you. Thank you. And that ability to do that and not shame me kept me here now, 24 something years later. And I'll never repay that guy. And so anyway, that's kind of my story about getting here. Alcoholics have affected my life negatively, but in recovery, they affected me positively over and over and over. I found my sponsor because I went to a cool meeting with my AA sober friend, and we went to a cool AA meeting, and we got there, and he was like this cool dude in a rock band, and he took me over there, and we get in the door as Friday night in Burbank, and he goes barefoot meeting. He goes, oh, hey, you go over there, and just pushed me off into the Al-Anon meeting. And I was like, I went in the Al-Anon meeting. That's where I mean, I met Ron and I met Josiah and I met all these people, man. It was cool. I met all these dudes, some of these dudes I know here tonight at that meeting. And those people didn't know me. They didn't know how cool I was. They had no idea how cool I was, y'all. They didn't know my last name. They didn't know nothing about me. I was low, and they seemed really happy to see me sitting in here today watching y'all hug each other. By the way, for the Zoom people, I'll address the camera like a trained media professional. For the Zoom people, Al-Anon tourism is now a thing. If y'all are not here, you can just come here and you can come in on a Thursday and go to this meeting. We can get you to a Friday night meeting. You can come to Saturday and Sunday. You can have a long weekend in LA and go to some of the best meetings of your life. I just want to say that. Like, that's a real thing. And I have friends all around the world. I've been to Florida now twice. I got a buddy's been here three times. John from Orlando. He's on the Zoom meeting every Saturday. Shout out to John. I talk to him like all the time. We have a lady from France that friends of ours have gone to meet. I just want to say that, man. Put a pitch in for that. But you'll get real hugs and you'll get people to say, hey, glad to see you. And they are glad to see you because you are saving their life. I showed up here. I was like, man, I hope this meeting's still here. And it is. And I love it. And going into that Friday night meeting and having those people not know me at all and just give me a hug and say, I love you. I love you. So good to see you. Oh my gosh. And over the weeks of going, I tell people they tricked me because I think that everybody knows better than me. And these people thought I was okay. And therefore, by that logic, I must be okay because they know better than me. I don't like myself. They do. Maybe they can see something I can't see. And that got me to be like, well, maybe then I'll do these steps, see what happens, you know? Not going to admit I'm powerless, but damn, was there some unmanageable shit happening that I could not deny. Unmanageable, I got that. And then you figure out, well, why is that unmanageable? Yeah, because I'm powerless, you know? Restore us to sanity. I'm 140 pounds soaking wet. Here I was at the Greek Theater yelling at a dude that I'm going to get in a fight with a guy that's whole face was bandaged because he'd already been in a fight. And he was drunk enough to not have nothing to lose. Insane, insane. And then, could a power greater than myself restore me to sanity? Well, I didn't do it. I couldn't do it. I'd given up. Maybe I'll try. So you make a decision to turn your will and your lives over the care of God as we understood him. First, as we understood him, I did not understand the God I was raised with. So I had to find a better, higher power. Probably the same higher power, really, when I think about it in my concept of spirituality, but whatever. Just a lot less people involved in that transaction. But the word care, man, nobody ever cared. Like to this day, my wife will like make me coffee sometimes in the morning on a weekend and bring it to me in bed. And that, I would pay $1 million for that feeling. I love that so much, that care. And for me, that's the higher power that I have. I have a story about that in a second. We're searching in fearless moral inventory. Yeah, it's not that bad. The secret, if those of you who are new and haven't done inventory anywhere, you're fine. The answer is we're all fine. I don't want to ruin the movie, but Bruce Willis is dead, and we're all fine. He was dead the whole time, and we've been fine the whole time. That's it. Admitted to God ourselves another human being, that's a really big deal because I am shameful. I'm the worst person ever. And when you do that fifth step and you go, well, here it is. First, a good sponsor is going to be like, well, that's all the bad shit, but like, what about the good stuff? What about whatever it is, right? And then it's like, okay, cool. And then getting to the end of it and having somebody go, hey, man, that was great. Good work. I love you. And understanding that I could then come back into these rooms, I could talk to that sponsor, and they know everything, all that shameful stuff. And they're like, whatever. Whatever, you're lovable. You are loved. That's a diff that sends you into the world in a different way. That sends you in a world that just makes you bulletproof in a way that I cannot describe. Six and seven, oof. I'm kind of back in that. I want to stop and talk about something so I get this in before I blow this time out of the water. Yeah, where am I now? So anyway, it got better. It continues to get better. Life is still also happening. Life is in session. Bad things happen. It's not all, cash and prizes. But if you live your life by these principles and you keep coming to these rooms, you can kind of only get so far off the track. So I've recently been in a process of inventory. A bunch of other people took my inventory. So let me just tell you, that's my experience. It's not my recommendation, but it was okay. I lived through it. But I am an Al-Anon, but really at my core, if you want to know really what I am, I'm an asshole, y'all. That's what y'all need to know about me. I'm an asshole, and I recover from it, a daily reprieve. I can't even say a daily reprieve. I get a reprieve every now and then from being an asshole. I laugh when this started because I keep moving the date back when it started. When it really started was in a guy in Hollywood, and a homeless guy came into our meeting because it's Hollywood, and he was getting a donut. And this guy had been coming in every now and then, and he was pretty unstable, and he was scaring some people. And this newcomer guy went in the back and just got in his face instead of de-escalating. So he did the equivalent of what I did with Brian. And then he was like, "Hey, man." So I walked out. I was like, "Hey, y'all, this is going. Hey, man, very cool." And happy smile walking everybody out, right? And homeless guy goes on his way and continues yelling that he has a knife and he's going to stab us in the face. And we're smiling. And this other newcomer was almost as angry. And I said, "Hey, man, are you cool?" And he goes, so self-righteous." And I was like, "God, Jules, what's wrong with that guy?" And then I was walking back in and I was like, "He's right." But and then shortly after that, my friend Mark G died. And I don't know if y'all ever got to hear Mark G, but Mark changed my life. He said, I'm Mark G and I'm a fear addict. He said, I like fear because it's readily available, cheap to manufacture. And that was his drug of choice. And I was working one day. I didn't go to the hospital to see him. I hadn't gone to the hospital. He'd been sick for a couple of months. It was a very quick illness. And they called me at work and they were like, "Hey man, if you're gonna come see Mark, you should come down here." I was like, okay. So I took lunch. I drove over to Hollywood to see him, and I was like, "Man, I'm not even going to go in." By this point, he was, not really conscious, and I was like, "I'm not going to go in, and I'm just going to stay here with and comfort the friends and family." And then they came out and they said, "Hey, come on in. It's time. Let's come on in." So we all walked in and surrounded his bed, and he passed away, and his family wasn't able to be there. His wife was there, but his parents and everybody weren't able to be there. But there were 12 or 13 people from this program with their hands on him around his bed, listening to music and just loving him when he passed. When they say you don't have to do anything alone, and when they say that in these meetings, they mean it. And that guy's family showed up later, but we were there with him. And it was a profound experience because for me, it showed me it's like, no, man, I don't have to be alone. There's one of these meetings. And there's someone on the end of that phone anytime. And that was profound. That started a run of about nine people that have passed away in the last year. And grief has affected me heavily. And that's not an excuse for my behavior, but it's certainly a factor in that. And so I just become a miserable person, man. I just bottomed out emotionally. I just was not the person I liked. And outwardly, I was still, I still crack a joke and fun and, whatever and all, but I just was not kind at a level that I didn't like. And a lot of people in my life got mad at me, and every one of them was right and justified. And it culminated with some friends being like, basically having an intervention. Hey, man, I'm gonna come over and hang out. And they're like, hi. And it was wild because it was just like TV intervention. It was like, hey, you're hurting yourself. But it wasn't drugs and alcohol. It was this other ism that I have. It was my control. It was, if you read Understanding Ourselves, my obsession, my guilt, my anger, all those things that we list that ironically are very much like alcoholism symptoms. And so, I moped around for a couple of days because it was painful and it felt bad. And I felt like everybody was mad at me. And then I went to meetings and I'd go to my meeting, home group. And even there, I felt like I was too much. And I was talking to a friend of mine at the meeting and I'm like, oh man, my friend Deb. And I'm like, Deb. And she's like, what's going on? I go, man, Deb, I'm a lot. And she said, we know you're a lot. She's like, what do you mean? Like you're hiding that? She's like, no, we love you. We love you. We love you. You're fine. You're fine. And that was the first crack in that feeling. And then I was able to do some inventory. One of my friends had written down some things for me. I had AV materials and I got to go through those. And it was so funny. Over 20 years in recovery, you're a lot less defensive about your stuff. So I'm reading through it and I'm like, yeah, that's fair. That's probably right. Oh no, that one? No, I don't think that was me. That, oh no, oh yeah, I definitely do that. And that was a hilarious experience, but I was able to go through a little, 10th step on my life and get back into that. And I was able to make amends quickly. Some I made direct amends and I sent, a letter or two and I talked to people. And then also I was just able to be, hey man, just how about you don't be that guy anymore? How about you just be better to people? How about you don't have to make a big deal out of it and make some big apology to somebody? How about you just treat them like a good, like a human? And in a couple of months, some of those people came back and said, I got to tell you, I appreciate it. You really did some work. I tell that story because like, it's not all, like it's not all smooth sailing when you get in these rooms. My mother's death uncovered so much, so much. And that experience of grieving was profound. But it also allowed me, it just gave me so much perspective. And in the process of going through her stuff, I put together so much of my life. It was like another inventory and it turned into that. So, the thing I think I want to share more about that was that what I really recognized was going through that emotional bottom, I forgot my higher power. I wasn't connected daily to my higher power. I mean, it gets baked into you. Just like you go to the meeting every week. It's just your routine. You do it, but I wasn't deeply connected to it. And I had an interesting experience recently where a guy called me as a newcomer, and when you get that program call and you're not giving advice like you would like to your buddy or something, and you're just listening to somebody, and you're like, oh, this person's hurting so bad. What do I do? And I just think, my higher power, came in. I was like, hey man, what's your higher power like? And he was going through this horrible relationship thing. And he said, yeah, man, it's interesting you asked me that. He goes, the guy I did the steps with, he just kind of ran me through those first three, got me to four. He just kind of knocked me through it. And he goes, I don't really know what my higher power is like, really. And I said, and I don't know, where it came from. I just said, oh man, I said, this is hard. I think you might want a higher power to give you some comfort. And I'd never thought of that. I never said that sentence in my life. And it was like, yeah, my higher power gives me comfort. This is hard. Life is hard. I feel bad. You know, I can lean on y'all, but when nobody else is around, I can lean on my higher power. And then I had a buddy call me a couple of days later, and I was like, hey man, what's your higher power like? And he described it, and I was like, to myself, I was like, huh, I don't know. I don't know if that would be enough of a higher power for me. And I was like, wow, okay, cool. And this dude struggles, man. This dude's got struggles. And I was like, oh wow, I wonder if that's connected. Didn't say a word, thank God, thanks to y'all. But I just had that thought. I was like, wow, yeah. So I had these two guys call me, and my third buddy calls me, man. I just had dinner with him over here before this. And he called me and he was telling me a story. And this guy's helped me so much. He talks to me about his recovery in a way, and I just love it. So he's talking about, he's talking to his sponsor, and he's doing like a workbook, doing a recovery workbook, and he's reading an answer to the sponsor. And it's one of those, it's like a question in a book, you know? And he's like, yeah, I got about 2 pages written about it. And I was laughing. It's like one question is like 2 pages. So he's reading and reading and reading. And finally, the sponsor goes, hold on, man, hold on, man. He goes, why? He goes, but why are we here? And he was like, well, and you know, trying to answer his sponsor. So he's like, because I have and he's just trying to make up, you know, anything to say. And his sponsor's like, no, why are we in this program? And he's like, because I have a God-sized hole in my heart. And he's like, no. Why? And he keeps rephrasing the question. And finally, it's amazing. He goes, why do people come to 12-step programs? And he goes, because they're addicted? And he goes, yes. And my buddy just goes, oh. And I went, I don't use drugs and alcohol. Am I addicted to certain behaviors? 100%. Do I ever get a day sober from control and fear and all my defects? Never. Never do I get a day put together 24 hours of emotional sobriety, but that's what we're all kind of trying to do here. And that hit me. It's like, oh yeah. And those calls, and then thinking about this thing in like an AA perspective, like I said, I'm not an alcoholic, but like read the big book. They're trying to stop something. It's like, ah, oh, I need to stop being an asshole. And for me, I'm really trying to apply that. I'm really trying to apply the 12-step methodology because I don't want to stop those behaviors. My wife works in recovery. She works in rehabs. Nobody wants to go to a detox. And it is painful and terrifying, I'm sure, for those people. And the only way they get through it is with the help of a higher power. And I've come to understand that now. I'm having a completely different relationship with the what it means. And I want to thank those of you who are double winners, sober guys in this program, sober women. I appreciate you. I do, because I've learned so much about alcoholism from the big book. I gotta look at something. Hold on. Y'all will laugh at me, but in addition, in last year, I got COVID twice in about 6 weeks. Good times. Hashtag Arkansas. And four years of pandemic here, went home, got it twice. Got a little brain fog. Chapter five, you know, we are not saints. No one has done anything like, you know, strict adherence to these principles. That thing for me, man, that reading for me gets me every time. We are willing to grow along spiritual lines. That's been my experience of the last year or two, is I found that I am willing to grow along spiritual lines, and I can bottom out, I can feel bad, I can get better. More important, I have a regulation system. I have all of y'all. I have friends who love me. Those people who came to me, those are people in recovery. Those are people who love me. Those are not people who wanted to discard me. Those are people who were like, hey, we know this is not you. We understand this is not you. We've seen you. It's a big deal. Because it's the men's meeting, I want to say, I checked out on my dad when I was in my teenage years. I checked out on my dad and my dad's side of the family for about 10 years. I lost 10 years of life with my father. And I went back, and I have a half brother and half sister down in Texas who I love very much. I have dual citizenship. Willie, I have dual citizenship. I don't know if you know that. And then after that decade, I still was pretty distant. And then when I got in recovery, I just wanted to know my dad loved me and was proud of me. And he had never said that to me, either of those things. And so, like they say in his program, every time I talked to him, I remember the first, I was up in Lompoc, and it was Father's Day, and I called him, and I got to the end of the call about, the horses and the weather and what was going on and on. I'm like, hey man, y'all can tell I'm old because how I do a phone. If I was young, I'd do this, but I do this. I talk to my dad, and I'm like walking around, and I said, I mean, literally voice trembling. Hey dad, I just want you to know that I love you. And man, I'm so proud of you. I'm so glad you're my dad. He said, me too, Bryce. And that was a big deal. Did that over and over. I love you. I love you. Love you. After a couple of years, we love you. After a couple more years, I love you, man. And then he's told me he's proud of me. And we built a relationship in these rooms because I built a relationship with you guys. You guys scare the shit out of me. Oh, by the way, when we tell like little soft Hollywood boys to come up here, just so y'all know, we tell them it's a patented term, by the way. We go, hey man, go up to La Cañada. And they go, what's it like? I go, it's cool, man. It's a bunch of dudes that look like they ought to be kicking your ass. And then they get up and like cry about their kids and shit. And everybody's like, really? And I go, yeah, man, it's healing as hell. Healing as hell. It's beautiful. Y'all may be not scared of men. Y'all may be able to be open and honest with people. Means I could be open and honest with women. Means I can talk to my wife about hard things because I talked about hard things with y'all. It's a powerful experience to heal your relationship with people of the same sex. For me, it was a really, really, really big deal. But yeah, I rebuilt that relationship with my father, and my mother's gone. My dad is alive. I love him to death. I can't imagine. I have a relationship with him that he never had with his father. It's a blessing, an amazing, amazing experience. I just wanted to get that in because that was something for me that was a really big deal. I kind of end with this that, like I said, my friend Mark G died, and I have a resentment against him. I realized earlier this year that I have a resentment against Mark. And I was like, how dare you fucking die before I get to have this argument with you? He maintained that he was a fear addict. And one day I was doing that, like, well, what am I scared of, right? What, list your fears. What are you scared? Well, what am I really scared of? Well, I'm scared of it. No, well, I'm scared of, no, that's, I'm scared every one of my fears is related to shame. Oh, I'm scared I have to lay my employees off. Why? Well, I'd be ashamed of that at the root. I know they have a higher power. I know they'll be okay, but it would be shameful for me. I'm scared y'all are gonna find out whatever. I'm really an asshole because I'm ashamed of that. Every one of my fears is shame. I am a shame addict. And I look at it and it's unbelievable to me. These steps heal that. They remove shame. I can call any of you. I trust you enough with my darkest secrets, the things I can't tell anybody else. I can tell you those things. You say, you smile, you nod, like you said to me. They go, yeah, me too. I feel it. If the world could experience this, we would have a far better and more loving world because I get a daily reprieve from my shame. The loss of a parent when you're a little older becomes very personal. You realize that you're in the last quarter. You realize that that's coming for you. I don't know how long I'm gonna get to be here on this earth, but I hope that I get to be with y'all for the rest of it. I love you very much. You gave me my life. I owe you everything. Thank you.